Hello and welcome to the First Take Film Club. I'm your host, Connor Norcott, and today I'm joined by my two best buds over here, Liam Jones and Luke Chandley. Liam, how are you, mate?
I am very good, mate. I have a week off. I have Bailey's in my hands, enjoying myself, enjoying some lovely Liam time. So a nice, you know, trying to recuperate, taking the lockdown vibes. Which I'm kind of enjoying. I'm kind of enjoying myself. I've been watching some Dickinson's Real Deal today, you know, just kind of going full deep into that daytime TV kind of days off vibes. And I'm feeling myself. I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying time off. It's great.
That is the perfect lockdown TV, is anything that's on between like 2 p.m. and 6 p.m., whether it's like Tipping Point, which I hate, or Dickens' Real Deal, which I also hate. It's still good value when you're in the lockdown, definitely.
What I realised is, sorry, this is just going off a little bit, but on Dickinson's Real Deal, he kept like flirting with these young girls and then looking to the camera and going, "Don't you dare write in, don't you write in." I was like, I think I might write in, like, stop it.
Okay, well, the other guy on this Dickinson's Real Deal podcast is Luke Chandley. Luke, how are you doing, mate? You doing okay?
Yeah, really, really good. Now I just want to watch daytime TV somewhere between 2 and 6. Yeah, I'm good, mate, thanks. I'm good. Just got a load of little bits going on at the moment in my life.
Oh, so, you've got some big bits going on, man. Come on, big them up.
Yeah, I've got little bits of the big bits. So I've started in business, an independent publishing house, and just all the things that you don't think about when you've got to do this type of thing, like set up a website and have an online store and be able to like have people pay you for the thing that you're trying to sell to them, and like just, you know, all the stuff that's like, that's going to take you 5 minutes, but there's like 600 of them, so it's like, oh my god, how many 5 minutes is that? So but I'm all right, really. It's like, what I really like is last few months especially, it's been like Monday to Saturday, just intense work, no TV on, just I've got to concentrate. And this type of stuff is like, I've got films on in the background, and like I can take a few minutes away to watch what's going on. It feels really, really refreshing and nice. So, yeah, all good, all really good. Thanks. How about you,
this
mate?
This is lovely. Honestly, I'm pretty good, but I'm a bit stressed. I've got a lot of uni deadlines. A lot of them are like general, not just one film related, but like a whole genre or a whole director related. So between watching the film that, you know, we're going to do for this podcast, which surprisingly enough in the title is Citizen Kane. I think I've watched Citizen Kane 3 times this week alone, because I just have films on in the background and then I'll close my work for a minute and watch them. And I think I've done this twice with Citizen Kane. So last night I put it on to go to sleep too. I couldn't sleep and just watched the whole thing again. So I'm fully Citizen Kane'd out the brain at the minute, but I'm pretty good actually. I'm pretty good. So yeah, before we get into like things, I will just throw in an opening question. This actually came from Liam today, because I was too busy to do the opening, like the opening questions and the agenda, and he helped us out big time here. Citizen Kane's regarded as like the greatest film, or one of, if not the greatest film of all time, but not for me. I've got a couple that I prefer over this. What about you guys? What do you reckon? What's the greatest film of all time in your opinions?
You go first. Do you want me to go? I actually think I was considering going like with all like of the daft options that I could go with that I think are like my greatest films, but like I actually kind of just think maybe The Dark Knight. Maybe I just think it's really like just fucking dead good. It's got a lot about it, hasn't it? But yeah, I mean, I think it's really sitting on the fence, isn't it, to say like, oh, it's so objective, because yeah, it is, but you give it a shout, can't you? But I just kind of think that might be my shout. Really, yeah.
It's a weird question, isn't it? Because it's not what is your favourite film of all time, because, you know, we have favourite films of all time that really aren't considered the greatest films of all time. Like, one of my favourite films of all time probably at the minute is like Avengers Endgame, but no way is that one of the greatest films of all time. Like, when you consider it to Citizen Kane or Casablanca or, you know, Taxi Driver or anything, you know, The Godfather, it's nothing compared to them. But if I'm going to be, I think in my opinion, I feel like people have a tendency to go look back, like look way, way back when they're asked about the greatest films. But I'm probably going to say, in my opinion, Whiplash. Just, it is also one of my favorite films of all time, but I think in terms of what it does, storytelling wise and kind of almost experimental at times, and it's just vibrant and just makes you feel kind of, I can't remember, I don't know if there's any of the films that kind of engross me so much as this film. And it's kind of, it's almost like the perfect melting pot, like of everything kind of coming together to make like this perfect film, in my opinion. So yeah, that's my shout. What about you, Connor?
That is a good one, man. Anytime Whiplash ever comes up on this podcast, I just wish one of us hadn't watched it so we could talk about it.
I know.
Greatest film of all time, like you said, is hard, and it's a stupid thing to even talk about, but we're stupid people, so let's talk about it. It's hard because, like you said, you go back, and now that you've said that you're going to try and put a modern spin on it, I'm thinking, oh shit, maybe I should do that. If initially I was going to say Vertigo, which I think the AFI, the American Film Institute, ranked Vertigo and Casablanca and Citizen Kane all as their top three, and they seem to change them about every 10 years. But I remember Vertigo was the first film I watched at uni, and I remember thinking, like, we watched it in a screening and we had to write about it, and it was the first one I ever wrote about, like, scholarly or anything. And I just remember being blown. Like, I watched it maybe 6-7 times in a month, probably, because I was preparing for this essay that I had to write. And it still doesn't get old. I love it so much. I love Alfred Hitchcock. I love Jimmy Stewart. And it's really dark and sinister. And it's a film that you can kind of view it from different lenses, whether it's genre or whether it's what it stands for as a commentary on America. And I'm a sucker for stuff like that. So if it wasn't Vertigo on a modern one, I'd have to go with There Will Be Blood, because modern day films, like modern day contemporary films.
That's a great shout, to be fair.
It's perfect.
You were going to say Blade Runner, to be honest.
I'm looking at a Blade Runner like piece of art in front of me, and I'm like, oh, Connor, you traitor. But there's been enough Blade Runner discussions in my life this week, so I don't know.
I was looking at some of the greatest kind of rankings, and there's a lot of official kind of critics boards that have had, I think Citizen Kane might have been top for like 4 years on the bounce, and then Vertigo took it off maybe like 10 years ago, and it does flip between, yeah, as you say, Citizen Kane, Vertigo, and Casablanca. You've got IMDb that has Shawshank Redemption as their number one on their greatest film of all time. And you've got Empire Magazine, who I think they only did like their ranking last year, and their number one, I'm pretty sure, was A Dark Knight. I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty sure it was A Dark Knight. So yeah, it is completely subjective, I think, but you do get the critics often saying Citizen Kane. And I read an article by Peter Bradshaw from The Guardian about how students, like film students and like students of film kind of across the board, really, and like its crit and their critics do often say Citizen Kane is their greatest film of all time, because I think, as we're going to get on later, it is almost like it's almost like a lesson in film in just under 2 hours. In terms of kind of the camera work and stuff like that, and the editing and the score and kind of everything within this film that came out, 80 years ago now? Well, 79 years ago. It's quite impressive. And I think we will delve right into it. And it's going to be an interesting chat.
Yeah, so let's just jump right into it then. So like you talked about, Citizen Kane came out, 79 years ago, 1941. It had a budget of just under $700,000, and it only made $1.6 million. It was a commercial flop when it came out, but slowly, I think maybe 2 or 3 years later, it quickly picked up pace, and that's down to Orson Welles being a controversial character, and I'm sure we'll touch on that in a bit. I'll just give a little like plot synopsis. So it follows the death of the media tycoon Charles Foster Kane, and his last word was Rosebud, and it kind of centers around how a certain reporter picks up on this word and scrambles to find out what it means, what it stands for, and who Charles Foster Kane really was. This is one of, like, we keep saying it, it's one of the most talked about films ever. It's often analysed to the death, and we're not really going to do that. We're just going to talk about what we liked and what we didn't like and parts that stood out to us. But it was both of you had a first take this week, isn't that right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Sick. Awesome. So I'm going to come to you first, Luke, then. First take, you watched it today, I'm sure, wasn't it, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah, today, yeah.
What did you think?
I liked it. I think it's always good to just say, like, kind of, only to give context to like, you know, what you think in your first take, like what you knew about it beforehand. And I, like, I don't know what, I had no idea. Like, I think I might have even messaged you in our little WhatsApp group that we always refer to, saying, like, it was only when I sat down and I was like, shit, I have absolutely no idea what this film's about. Which I think with films that are almost like less famous, you know more about, because almost like you just, like, when you know about films, you know about Citizen Kane, and you almost just like, I'm not going to look into that because it's so huge. Like, I don't know whether you're almost like, well, I must know about that, or like, it's just too big in front of you that you almost don't look into it, maybe. I don't know if that kind of makes sense. But so I didn't have a clue. And it's only when I sat down, I was like, I don't have a freaking clue. I'm going to have to, like, really, like, pure, like, have a look and concentrate here. So going into it, I didn't have any expectations, which is really good, apart from, obviously, like, everyone kind of does say, like, you know, I think unless you absolutely hate the film, I imagine a lot of people who are critics will have this in that, like, if you ask them top whatever, top five, top 10, it's going to be there. So other than that expectation. And like, I enjoyed it, yeah. I think I found the way it starts is a bit unusual. Like, the way that you're introduced to, like, the guy, like, Charles, and you're introduced to kind of, like, how we're going to navigate the timeline of this person's life is not that straightforward, I don't think. Like, you eventually gather that, basically, like you said earlier, it's a detective kind of looking into his death, but it's a vehicle to navigate his life, really, for us. And I just think getting to the bit where you start navigating his life is a little bit jarring. But from then on, it was really easy watching and really interesting. And we will come onto it, and I imagine Liam will come onto it as well, how, like, it's really, it feels really quite relevant, the whole, like, content. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. Like, I didn't, sometimes you can tell when you're watching an older film, I think. And I mean that negatively, as opposed to, like, I positively kind of noticed it, whereas, like, it's more the sound and, like, the accents and, like, obviously the black and whiteness of it. And I did like that, and I did enjoy it, and I don't have a bad word to say about it, really. Like, yeah, I just enjoyed it. I just enjoyed it, mate.
Awesome. Liam, what about yourself then, mate? Because I feel like this one was going to be right up your street. When we did Casablanca a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month and a bit ago now. I was really surprised how much, like, we all loved this film.
Yeah.
Absolutely loved it. And this came out, what, just a year before then? Same time period, completely different in storytelling and narrative and techniques. But I think quite a lot of it jumped out to you, Liam. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I really, really liked this film. I think, obviously, there are... I don't know if you get many people that do come out and be like, I hate this, I hate everything about it, it's too kind of, like, artsy, I don't like Orson Welles and whatever, but I feel like you can have your opinions about Orson Welles and still enjoy this film, because at the time that he made this, like, he was like 25 years old. He made it in, like, theater and stuff like that, and radio, but hadn't really broken into film at all. And this was his directorial debut, I think. Am I right with that, Connor?
Yeah.
So, I think going into this, I kind of tried to take everything into consideration in that, obviously, it's like 80 years old. It's his directorial debut, and how impressive that is, considering the kind of magnitude and, of it, and the kind of the techniques he uses, kind of almost learning on the job. I think, like, when the film finished, I was just kind of in awe of how kind of impressive it is. I think I said to you boys just off air, kind of like, did you actually enjoy it, or were you more kind of appreciative of kind of the importance of it, and kind of what it stands for and kind of how it shaped cinema to date? And I did, there are definitely elements I enjoyed. I love the kind of how they open the film, like the first kind of 10-15 minutes, the way they kind of have this, this almost like propaganda type newsreel that kind of highlights his life after his death. And it's kind of immediately, it kind of sums up how kind of manipulative a media tycoon can be. And, you know, he is really quite manipulative. You know, I wrote down in my notes, because obviously we're introduced to him as a young boy when we do actually have a kind of proper investigation into his life, rather than a kind of manipulated look into his life. And he was quite a sweet boy. And I wrote down, do we think Rupert Murdoch was ever a nice man or a nice person?
No, like, I do not.
Like, can power corrupt you so much that you turn into a complete bastard? Like Charles Kane, he does show flutters of being a good person. Obviously, you see him as a sweet, innocent boy, and the kind of heartbreak in his eyes when he's being told that he's been taken away from home to kind of be this tycoon, you know, and kind of being thrown into that at a young age, you can see why that would mess up a person, kind of their kind of whole view on life. Because it's referenced so many times about how, yeah, he doesn't love people. He just wants people to love him. And it's probably to do with the fact that like he was taken away from his parents at such an age. I think it's kind of, like, reference as well that his dad's a bit of a dick, like a bit quite not a very nice man, but it's his mum that he has this like lovely connection with. But then to even kind of be almost kicked out by your mum as well, because it was kind of her, she was quite heavily involved in him moving out, moving away, because in her mind it would give him a better life to kind of be to grow up with money and become, you know, involved in like media and the newspapers and stuff. But yeah, just my first take of this is it's a really impressive film with elements that I really enjoyed. I think sometimes it's a little bit hard to enjoy at times, but nonetheless, like, you do appreciate kind of almost every moment of it, the kind of what it means and what it represents now. Kind of like every year that goes by, this film kind of becomes more and more relevant and more important. And it's kind of, yeah, it shows really when you're watching it, like you can tell why and how it has become this kind of ginormous kind of success in a way.
I think that's really interesting. It poses a weird question, that does it become more relevant, or does it just stay the same and these things keep happening and it's a continuous problem? Like, that you could have a whole podcast series probably on a conversation like that and extrapolate it through other films. But I really liked, before we talk about like the plot and the characters and stuff like this, I really like what you just said there, Liam, that you enjoy, but some of it doesn't really click with you. Like, maybe not click with you, but it doesn't, you struggle to enjoy all of it. It kind of reminded me, and I've watched it a lot this week, so maybe I've just gone a bit mad. It kind of reminded me of Goodfellas in a weird way, where I've watched Goodfellas more than 50 times easily. I love it. But I've had so many people watch it for the first or second time and say, like, yeah, the first half's awesome, but the second half's depressing as hell. And I get this with Citizen Kane, where, like, I'm kind of rooting for Charles Kane here, but he's a dickhead. And then once, I know they tell it in a very kind of pseudo-linear way, but when it gets to the heaviness and you see him start to lose everything that he's accrued over the years, and his affair, it becomes unraveled, his marriage becomes unraveled, he starts losing money, losing the newspaper, etc. I find that really hard to watch. Maybe I'm just too empathetic, I don't know, because he's clearly not the best guy in the world, but you kind of root for him.
I listened to a really interesting it's Radio 3's they have these essays, they call them, and obviously it was this kind of five-part series on Orson Welles, and they were talking about how in Citizen Kane, obviously Charles Kane is a really hard character to kind of empathize with and sympathize with, and he's kind of a dick who makes bad choices and doesn't treat people very nicely, as particularly as he grows older and more bitter. So kind of what happened was people kind of, because they were trying to root for him so much, it ended up projecting onto Orson Welles as a person. So then kind of the public started to kind of project all of this kind of, I guess, almost like empathy and stuff onto him. And then that's why he kind of went so famous so quickly, kind of after this film went out, after this film came out, maybe a couple of years after the film came out, because it was kind of I think maybe like 7 months after this film, like Pearl Harbor happened. So there was like a lot going on during the war around this film. So it was probably didn't have the best kind of release in cinemas. But yeah, I think his stardom kind of just skyrocketed. Not to mention, obviously, in terms of Academy Awards, he won with Herman J. Mankiewicz for the writing, and he was nominated as well for leading actor and director. So it's kind of immediately he's like thrown into this stardom, and people can actually look at him and think, right, your character was a bit of an ass, but we'll see what you're like and see if we can give you some love. It turns out, obviously, after a while, that probably wasn't the case either. But I think it's really interesting, like, how one film can kind of make you and break you at the same time. It's really interesting.
It's almost like that, the first album syndrome, isn't it? Where, like, your first album comes out and it's a smash hit and you blow up and you're the biggest thing in the world, and then next minute you're, you know, down in the dumps and you're not really doing much else. It reminds me a bit of... In fact, I find it really hard watching this film now. Like, I'd watched it before we were doing the podcast anyway, but I find it quite hard watching it now and looking at Charlie Kane as a character, because it just seems like it's Orson Welles in a nutshell. It kind of becomes quite prophetic about what his life actually turned out to be, and I find that quite sad and quite, I don't know how to word it. It's almost quite like humbling almost.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's like his like career kind of went the wrong way. Like, Citizen Kane should have been his big kind of film to sign off with, you know, this Oscar-winning epic. But it was actually the film that he started with, and then his career kind of gradually got worse and worse and worse, which is really interesting. Like, he like ended his career making like commercials and stuff. Like what was the notorious story about him making, like, was it some alcohol commercial, and it took him forever to try to like get the shot that they wanted, because he just wouldn't play ball.
He was quite a nefarious, he essentially was a con man, to be honest, and how he wrangled this contract from RKO, Warner Brothers, without ever making a film ever. And he wrangled this contract. They gave him complete license into not only cast the film, shoot the film, direct the film, write the film, star in the film, but also pick the crew that he wanted, fire people that he didn't want on the set. And he got a crew that was essentially just a bunch of youngsters, young people that he either grew up with or trusted or had the right vigor and go get him attitude that he thought would work. And it actually worked. And it's almost like, oh, it shouldn't have, because of humility, and we don't want that. You shouldn't get lucky straight away, but it did, and he kind of captured lightning in a bottle here. Yeah, so it centers on the reporter called Thompson, and he essentially goes through the people that were closest to, or potentially not as close as you find out, with Charles Kane, as he tries to decipher what Rosebud means and what, you know, Charles Kane was actually like as a man. I remember the first time I watched this, it didn't really resonate with me what they were doing and why they were doing it, but it actually works really well. And going through these characters that are in some way tied to Charles Kane is what makes the film kind of ring home the most, because you realize that he actually wasn't as close. He wasn't close to anyone. Everyone knew him, but no one really knew what he was like as a person, or not. Everyone knew him as like Charles Kane, the politician, or the the runner of this magazine or newspaper, not Charles Kane, the man. And how did you guys feel about that as it kind of went through, the kind of decision to rely on this reporter to essentially tell the story?
Well, because there's so many facets to this person's life that, like, you've almost kind of got to have someone who's eventually going to move it on. So, like, I feel like the reporter is, it's just a vehicle, isn't it, just to tell different parts of the story, and it doesn't necessarily, like, that can happen. And because a lot of elements of this person's life change, both from his age, but also whoever you speak to, it can feel, I imagine, without like this reporter to be the one thread through the film, it could probably feel a bit bumpy. If you're going from, like, you know, his younger life where he was like quite carefree, a lot of it, like a lot of that bit reminded me of The Wolf of Wall Street, where like there was there was this one man who was like this cheeky guy who was like, oh yeah, I don't care about spending money, it's just my money, or the headline creates, you know, the bigger the headline, the bigger the story, and all the, you know, fancy free. And then you've got the story from, like, I'm not speaking to his wife, but from, like, how you think about his wife, and then kind of his, I suppose, his partner, and then all, you know, and all this stuff. And I imagine it could probably have felt a bit like, fucking hell, this is all a bit all over the place. But actually, every 25 minutes or every 20 minutes, you go back to this reporter and you remember, oh, well, actually, yeah, these are just elements of this guy's life, and the reporter is actually the story arc, really. So I think that's, like, that's good, and that's not something I necessarily thought about before, and obviously that's with you saying it now and just asking about him. But yeah, I thought it worked well, considering what, maybe if it was just almost like a biopic of a person, mm-hmm. maybe it would have felt a bit more all over the place. But it was really a good way to reflect on this person's life by gently always moving through the current timeline as well.
I fully agree with you. Oh, sorry.
Sorry. I was just going to say, by doing that, you get like this extra layer, and it's kind of, it's almost like an amalgamation of different genres within this film. You kind of have like the drama of kind of his downfall. You have kind of almost like satirical elements, almost with like that newsreel opening at the start, because and then it cuts to the guys that the journalists that have just made it, and they're kind of like laughing about it, and you know, like then it kind of, that's where they come up with this idea of trying to get maybe find something a little bit more interesting about his life, because you know, this newsreel is basically just a cop out in a way, because it just shows the good things, you know, quote unquote, that he has done in his life. And then obviously you've got like this, all like it, this investigative, almost detective element of it, with this reporter who's going from person to person trying to get information on him. And then you also have this, like, as the film kind of gets towards like its final third, you have this real strange element where it becomes like it's weird, almost like a desperate musical in a way, where you have his second wife who is who he is more trying to force into this kind of, to be a star almost, but like all you get is kind of her embarrassing herself time after time, and then you even get like the incredible kind of standoff, face off, whatever you want to call it, that he has with his kind of like long-term colleague, Jedediah Leland, who I really like. I really like that character. I think it's great, because you kind of see him throughout Charles's life as the one guy who actually does have kind of a cynical look in his eye every time he's speaking, rather than kind of everyone else who is lapping it all up. And obviously the reporter does go to Jed, kind of obviously following his death, and he is quite like frank about how much of an arse Charles has been. But he didn't, interestingly enough, because obviously they have that interesting kind of conversation when Charles almost fires him. Well, he does fire him. He says, Jed goes, oh, I didn't think we were talking. And he says, yeah, we are, you're fired. And like, that's brilliant. It's so good. There's so many like lines in this that are great. I think that there's one before I forget about it, where Charles is talking about kind of like his upbringing, and kind of obviously he was almost like given it for free, this life, and he was like, I always choked on that silver spoon, when he's talking to some of his colleagues, and it's just it's just a brilliant line. Like, it's just so perfect. It just sums up kind of it sums up almost like his like disdain and kind of his almost like annoyance at like his life. I think he almost like obviously he doesn't appreciate it at all, and not that I'm saying he should, because he didn't want that life. So why would you appreciate all of this money and stuff when all he wanted to do was, you know, play with Rosebud and, you know, stay with his mum, you know, in his little home, and like have a more of a humbling life rather than this rich, extravagant, you know, tycoon life.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because like when we were talking just before we started actually talking about Citizen Kane, about our what we think are the greatest films, something that always sticks out to me is the legacy of a film and what it says about either a one period of time or a country or a genre or a bigger topic as a whole. And you can view this film through so many different lenses that you could almost watch it once from just a pure film point of view. You could watch it, and we've spoken about this in our group chat, that every line has like six or seven different meanings. It's like breaking down a fucking Kendrick Lamar song over 3 hours. It's mad. But one thing I really love, and we'll I just want to touch on it quickly, is that we are shown everything through what the reporter finds out. So everything you see is what someone is telling the reporter. So you're only ever getting secondhand information on this man. And that's a really, like, the irony there that Charles Kane just, he was actually attracted to people who didn't know who he was, because he wanted people to love him for who he is and not the reputation that he has. When we're watching this film, we're seeing accounts from all these other people. And we don't fully get the full picture of who he is. And I think that is really, really impressive. And it speaks quite well, because you see quite a lot of conflicting statements or images about him. Like, on one hand, people are telling you he's a really kind and caring man. Other times you see he's going behind his wife's back and having an affair. Or on one hand, he's accepting awards. And the other hand, he's actually, you know, starting wars in Spain and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. And Leland, like you touched on, Liam, is the character that I think most people gravitate towards, because he is like the moral compass of the film. And he's my favorite character for sure. In fact, him and, oh my, I can't remember the other guy's name now, but they're kind of like a two little, like a buddy cop duo. They're almost like the Timon and Pumbaa of this film. I bloody love them guys.
Well, I think just touching on what you said there though, like, so we're finding out, yeah, like secondhand stories of this guy, of Charles, and, you know, let's just say they are secondhand, and they may be elaborations of the truth or caricatures of the truth slightly, but it's just ironic that like that's how he made his hand in the money, I suppose. Mm-hmm. He was brought into money, wasn't he? But how he made his money was that, and him elaborating or bending or lying about the truth, and then you've got a situation where actually, in this film, especially to us, we only know him through either what may be true or what may not be true, or the headline of the story that we're watching may actually be bigger than the thing that happened. But he hasn't got any control over that, like everyone else hasn't got control over the lies that he told. So it's like a bit of a, yeah, just like a really interesting like little thing where like I would never have in my life said that had I not kind of just been listening to you guys discuss that then. And it's just interesting.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like, are the things we see even as kind of extreme as they were in reality? When we have the kind of shot of Kane when he's kind of addressing his audience as he's running for governor, and it's almost like Hitler-esque, isn't it? Where he's got this massive kind of, he's got this big picture of himself behind him, and the way that he is kind of centered, and the way everything is kind of shown behind him and in front of him, it does look like obviously, and coming out at the time as well, where like them images were surfacing of like Hitler like rallying his like Nazis with these big grand like mass kind of announcements and whatever, and
the way he gesticulates as well, like he's always very handy, isn't he?
That I can only think that was almost done on purpose to try and make you have a very, very negative opinion of Kane at this moment in time. And you also get like moments later, that shot, which is like, it's so kind of, well, it might be one of the most relevant shots to what's happening right now, when it's they have two newspaper front pages, and one says,
I love that so much.
One says Kane wins, and one says fraud at ballots or something like that. If that doesn't sum up fucking Donald Trump, you know, what? There's so many things in this film. Obviously, yeah, you're being told from a different point of view, but if you're going to take it for face value, then you would think that he's a pretty terrible person, or becomes to be a quite a terrible person, which is kind of obviously, I guess, why there's so much to unpack, because are we going to believe this to be true? Because obviously you can go into, again, like a full-on debate on, you know, he's been thrust into this life, so what do you expect? You know, it's almost forced upon him.
He has this really great quote near the end of his days, and I think he's talking to, not Leland, but the other guy's name. I can't remember now, and it's driving me mad. I can't remember it. And he has this great line where he says, I would have been a great person if I didn't grow up rich. And someone goes, do you not think you are a great person? And he was like, that's beside the point. So there's little lines, little throwaway, not throwaway, they're really central. Every line is central, because like we spoke about, it can be analyzed and picked apart for probably hours, but you know, we're not going to do that. We'll let smarter people than us. I'm speaking for myself here, smarter people than me.
You're definitely speaking for me as well, I'll be honest with you.
Okay, fair enough. So yeah, I think what an ambitious fucker this guy must be to make a film as encapsulates not just countries, but you know, why bigger themes that can be explained on a 1 hour podcast here. It blows me away every time I think about it. It really, really does.
I think you said this, didn't you, earlier, about we were talking on WhatsApp, I think, between me finishing a film and you doing work, and like Liam, I don't know why I mentioned Liam,
because drinking Bailey's probably.
But yeah, drinking Bailey's. I don't know what he was doing. But like, well, before the podcast, and he said that Orson Welles himself said that he was just I can't remember the word that was used, but like basically naive and ignorant about maybe the industry as a whole, and as we and that links in maybe to Liam's point, where the less ignorant you became, the more you are confined, so maybe your career does get a little bit worse, maybe. But I think just going in, I don't know, when you don't, it's hard to describe, but I just feel like that ignorance has probably allowed him to just basically do what he wanted. And especially if you're, you know, like you said, where he was allowed to kind of do what he wanted, that just fuels the ignorance, because you ask like, oh, well, this is what it must be like all the time. Like, how do you know? I can choose who I want. I can sack who I want. I can star in the film. I can direct the film. I can have, you know, this, that, and the other. And I think what allowed him to have such a boss debut was the fact that, like, because he was ignorant, there was nothing to scare him.
Yeah,
maybe like, you know, where I think especially like, and I link this back in absolutely no real context, but like the stuff that I'm doing now, it's like, you know, I didn't fucking know what's around the corner, but that's good for fucking me, you know. And in the same with this, like, if you're just going, you know what, let's just fucking make this film, and let's just, I'm gonna do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I think naivety and ignorance also actually helps creativity. So like, if you've not got a huge budget, or maybe you're working with who you want, but you're not working with the best, actually you've got to be creative with it.
Yeah.
And you've got to have imagination. And if it's the genius who's got to have the creativity, then you're going to come out with something that's extra special at the end. And you know, if you haven't got that naivety and you haven't got that ignorance, you are shackled in by the norm. And completely. Genius isn't the norm. Genius is genius. And I think I think maybe trying to chase that genius afterwards is a lack of ignorance. So it's, you know, like you say, like his career maybe was never going to get, not necessarily better than this, but as good as this, because he knows what that was. And you're always going to second guess yourself a little bit.
That's really true, isn't it? And I think one of the main elements of how well this film is made and its legacy and why it's so relevant and so well polished is because of the collaboration between Orson Welles and Greg Toland, who's the cinematographer. He was this really incredibly experienced director of photography. He'd worked on Grapes of Wrath, the adaptation of the, you know, the quintessential American novel, apart essentially. He also worked on a bunch of John Ford films. And he was at the top of his game and was like, you know what, I've learned, I've done everything I can do. I've learned all I can from the typical studio system. And he wanted to work with like a young upstart to go back to his roots, basically, and hopefully he can build himself up in a different way and learn more stuff. And then he met Orson Welles and realized that this guy was like, at this time at least, was on another planet, ridiculously creative, like a boy genius, proper wonder kid type, Football Manager 2021 wonder kid. And he was just so inspired because he had no fear. Orson Welles just wanted to do things that hadn't been done before, didn't understand why they hadn't been done, and was like, well, we're going to do them this way. And it was left to Greg Toland and his team to kind of figure out how to do it. And off air, Liam, you talked about some of the techniques that were used, and well, like they might have been used maybe before this film came out, but it was popularized by this. You talked about Liam, they had tables that would split in half so the camera could dolly back and it would, you know, come back in frame, and it was like nothing, it was out of place. They even did that with like signs above the street to make it look like they used really high Dutch angles, really acute, really high angles, and bring the camera all the way down to give like oppressive feels. They were the first film to ever really pioneer like low ground shots to make characters look really oppressive and ominous. And there's so many little things that are done perfectly to the T in every scene. And I think that's another reason why this film is so revered. And Liam, you put it in the agenda, it's like a masterclass.
Yeah.
Of filmmaking completely. It actually scares me a little bit watching it, because there's so many things that you forget to do, at least I forget to do if I'm thinking about filmmaking. I don't know how he was able to do this. I've got no idea.
No, I think one of the most impressive things, like technically, that I picked up on was like that deep focus lens and the kind of what it actually looks like, like, and what you can do with that in terms of he'll be like, at the front, in the foreground, and then there'll be like, there's like a window, it's like a shot where there's like windows in the background, and he looks like gigantic and then as he walks back, he suddenly becomes dwarfed as he goes into the background, and the windows are actually way bigger than they seemed at first. And it's kind of like things like that that are actually, you know, it's not something that would, if you're not looking for it, or if you're not asked, and that's what I wrote down, that I think most of like the trickery in this film is pretty seamless.
Yeah.
Like unless you know what they're doing, and unless you actually look for it, it doesn't really like stand out in a way that would ever make you go, oh, why are they doing that? That's a bit pointless. Everything that's done is actually, when you think about it, like everything is actually done for a reason, like in terms of like, even with like when they use a deep focus lens and, you know, he's going into the background and he's being dwarfed, like, not that we're going to be like, this isn't like a lesson in, because I don't really understand half of what is done in this film, but obviously it's mirror, like when camera shots are actually like, their shots are actually mirroring like how the person is feeling at that moment in time, or, you know, like he feels like dwarfed, or he doesn't feel great at that moment in time. And that's kind of like, I suppose it's like cinema student, film student basics in terms of what you would kind of learn in first year of uni. Like I even learned stuff like that in, like, I did media in college, and we would watch things like that and kind of we were taught to pick up on things like that. And it's interesting that like a film that is regarded as one of the greats, like that's how important it is. Like it's taught at the beginning of people, of film students kind of understanding and learning about film. I think like that's like really cool that you have a film like that that is so old, but is still so relevant today. And probably will be forever in terms of teaching like students.
I completely agree with you. And with film being such a, well, it's still a relatively new medium in comparison to other art forms, whether it be painting or art or sculpture or dance or anything. It's really interesting that the film is considered the greatest, or at least one of top five for most people anyway, is the film that does all the practical things that are still considered relevant now. It still does them well, does them simply. And it all serves the narrative as well. It's not just, you know, for show. It all adds into hidden meanings and deeper meanings. And like I said, in a way more in-depth way, other people will pick this film apart. But for me, there are a certain couple of little moments like that that stick out. I don't know if you guys have any off the top of your head. Do you remember any little moments from the film that, whether it's an actual piece of filmmaking that did stick out to you or didn't stick out to you?
Things in general that stuck out to me, I think, were the, Liam touched on it earlier, the... I think it's the scene where he's talking to a crowd about his campaign for governance. And just like I said earlier, the gesticulation about him and the way he's moving his arms and the way he's really emoting and quite like angry in the way he's putting over his views. That reminded me of like,
I love that scene so
much. A tyrant, really. It's a boss scene. And I think it's really weird that, like, I think, was it yesterday? One day, I don't know, maybe yesterday or the day before, I watched Jojo Rabbit. And obviously, like, the Hitler thing there. So that's kind of front of mind a little bit, even though the two examples I'm giving are nowhere near each other. But I think maybe whether that's why I just thought, and with the film being made in 41... But I just think I like all stuff like that in general. Like, there's a lot of that type of thing in, or a bit of that type of thing in V for Vendetta with, like, the whole, it's not tyranny, but what would you call it? It's not a utopia, is it?
It's dystopia, isn't it? It's a dystopia.
So, like, and just that vibe that it gives there, I like that, and I do generally like that in films anyway. And just another thing that stuck out to me in general, which isn't there, want to go deep into, is just like the dialogue at the beginning,
good.
But after like the first 25 minutes where you are kind of going into his early life as like a media mogul, and just like, it's quite happy-go-lucky, and it's quite like I suppose, like you said before, the first half is very just like, I don't know, it's more lighthearted.
It's fun, isn't it? Yeah, it's fun.
And I just think all the stuff, just the dialogue in that, and the conversations he has, and even like the naivety that he is as this character early in his life reflects maybe the naivety of Orson Welles during his actual film, but like the naivety where he's just like, oh, we'll just do this. Like, oh, but you're like the editor and director and manager of this newspaper. Yeah, well, so I'm going to do it then, aren't I? And I'm going to just hire these 10 people from the because I've got the money. And the way he says it all is just so like exciting and interesting and just like really fun. And I think that is, you know, definitely the first hour or the hour between in the middle of the film is something that I really loved and that stuck out for me.
That is, sorry, just before you jump in there, Liam, that bit you just talked about where he kind of goes to another newspaper magazine or newspaper firm or whatever and buys all the writers. And he says it 6 years ago that he wanted to do this. And then you get that kind of transition where he takes the picture. That can fuck off. That's the best thing I've ever saw.
That was genuinely like fucking phenomenal. I've watched this film before.
And I forgot about it. And I was like, oh my God, I hate this guy. I hate them all. They're so fucking smart and clever. And it doesn't make any sense logistically because they're all wearing the same clothes as 6 years ago. But it works. Just let it happen.
What I like about that is as well, like, there's two parts to it. So let's take that particular element of like that particular scene. I don't know which is more impressive. There's doing that, but then there's, okay, we really want to do this thing, and like I, you know, things that have never been done before, I don't fucking know them. I'll wait for them to happen, then I'll be like, oh yeah, that's really good. But then someone's
originality,
gotta have gone.
Yeah,
someone's
yeah.
got to have gone. Oh well, he's got to have gone, and the cinematographers and the you know everyone involved in the film have got to have gone. Let why don't we do this thing? And we've got to be the people to do it, so it's got to look great.
Mm-hmm.
It's never been done before, so we can't necessarily go, here's an example of the thing I want to do.
Yeah.
So there's both, there's the, all right, we're going to do this thing, I've got an idea, and then there's doing the idea, and the both of them, like, I can't tell which is more impressive, but both of them are fucking sick.
And even the transitions in the film is what serves narrative as well. And you look at other filmmakers that do stuff like that nowadays, like Edgar Wright is big at that. All of his transitions are part of the film, part of the narrative, yeah. even if it's just stylistically, it all makes sense. Being able to do this in 1941, look, I don't know. I don't know films from 1939. Maybe they did it before and I'm not giving them credit. I don't know. But that scene, every time I watch it, every time I know it's coming, I'll stop what I'm doing and just go, Yeah, that's a good film.
It's so impressive. You've got that, like, I love that whole, like, the 30 minutes or so when he is just having fun and he's having a great time and he's got the dancers with him and he's all having a laugh. And as I was reading up about it, I was read, like, a thing that, like, Scorsese was saying, and he literally, like, copied that almost entirely, that whole scene with the dancers and whatnot. He copied that whole scene and put it in The Wolf of Wall Street.
It
really does, though, like that whole kind of chaotic but fun feeling surrounding like this this like tycoon, and like kind of what it's like at the start is this excitement and craziness, and like you're with your pals who are also your colleagues and you're just kind of getting shit done, and it doesn't feel like work because you're having so much fun and you're getting drunk all the time, and like
that much was like us in like, the good old days much,
in the good old days. But going to like one of my favorite things from the film, it's not so much a scene in particular, but it's more so the fact that, like, in terms of the reference to his wife and child dying, you only hear about it in the newsreel at the start, really, and then it's not mentioned at all. So then when you get to the point where he's older, mm-hmm. but it's not really you've not seen it happen on screen, so you kind of have to like fill in the blanks yourself. But like you almost forget that this has happened. But then the fact that it's not referenced, like in terms of like when people are explaining his life,
mm-hmm.
it's really kind of, it's like another layer to him as a person. Like, was he so self-centered that he wasn't affected by it, or was he so affected by it that he didn't tell people about it, which is why it's not in it? Do you know what I mean?
Didn't even click onto that. That's really good. I'd give you a fucking distinction in your master's for that, Liam. Well in.
That was really good though.
I did. That was great. I listened to like 75% of it because on the screen that I'm watching Citizen Kane on the background was just that scene that we were talking about with the photographer. And I was thinking Liam's like making it like a really good, like he's not just going, this film's boss. He's like saying why it's boss. Uh-huh. And I can't just be like, everyone shut up, the scenes
that
on.
Bit's on. Can we pause for a minute?
Love it all.
This is good,
thought,
you know.
I never thought about it. Honestly, when you said before about his wife and child, like I just never, honestly, it was just like, oh, shit.
That's the thing, though, because it's just thrown in at the start, like in a newsreel that was created by like his guys to kind of, you know, as a kind of piece to him, like an obituary type of thing.
And all they do as well is they go, shame, and they move on.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you're talking about, they don't get bogged down in the minutiae of the negative things.
Mm.
Because from their point of view, they're only interested in the sensationalist, bigger headlines, bigger story kind of ideology there. Oh, that's
I think what you do get, in terms of like, obviously, we're talking about how obviously we're seeing his life from the viewpoint of other people. But what we do actually get in that newsreel is actually things that he has said because he's been caught on camera saying them. And there was a bit where he says, I've spoke to France, I've spoke to Germany, I've spoke to England. I have it on good authority that there's not going to be a war. They can't afford it. There's not going to be a war. You can mark my words.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's just, It's so, and that kind of, in a sense, does support the fact that, you know, because that's him on camera for real, does support some of the things that you see when it's being, when he's being depicted from other people's points of view. You know, it does kind of back their points up of him being quite almost, you know, manipulative and, you know, very, very tycoony, very Murdoch-y, yeah, basically.
I really wanted to try and avoid saying the R word, but we put it out there or not. But it is, sorry, I feel really bad about cutting you off there, Luke, but like, no, it's hard to not draw parallels to modern day here, whether it's Trumpism or Murdochism or just scumbagism in general. Yeah. It sticks out a lot for me. You actually wrote in the agenda here, Liam, that the themes and how they're relevant today and the power of the tycoon. Once again, it's one of these films that you can view through all these different lenses. I never focus on this part ever, and I always think about it after I've watched it, that maybe next time I watch it, I'll think about it as a commentary on this and absolute power corrupting absolutely. But I always view it as just a sole character study of how flawed this individual is. But if you did view it this way, would you just mind elaborating a little bit on that concept?
On the whole tycoonism of it.
Yeah, because obviously you can draw these parallels to people like Robert Murdoch or the idea that businessmen in general shouldn't be in these massive positions of power, whether it's media or government.
So what I took from it in that sense is essentially the corruption of power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it does corrupt many people.
Yeah.
I think, you know, as soon as you know that you can influence elections and you can influence what people think, I think it's going to go to your head immediately. As soon as you know that you have that many readers / viewers / listeners, I think it'd be hard for it to not go to your head. In no way am I sticking up for any of the bad dickheads that do these things. But that's kind of where I was thinking, like, in terms of like the Rupert Murdochs of this world and the Donald Trumps of this world, like, not so much Donald Trump, because he actually, I don't think he's had to work for anything.
Yeah.
Whereas Rupert Murdoch, on the other hand, has actually worked for his empire. Like, yet he was given one newspaper, I think, by his father in just Australia, and built that into, and that was like, that's an exact parallel. Like, it's so, like,
it
that's
really
exactly
is,
what
it?
Happens to Charles.
Yeah.
Charles Kane. He obviously is offered loads, but he only takes one newspaper, but still manages to create this this massive kind of following and industry just off the back of that. Oh, he's like, in the film, is, I think it'd be fun to run a newspaper. That's what he says.
Love and hate that line, and because it just shows that it's a toy for them.
I know exactly. Yeah. That's kind of,
well,
like,
I think just on what you were saying then, about the reflection of then to now and like the parallels and stuff. Parallel was the word I was looking for, but I said reflection because I couldn't think of it.
the P word.
That one. The parallels. I think it's. I think definitely it's a corruption of power, but I also think it's a corruption of power to make you think that what you are saying, everyone else either wants or probably needs to hear. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like the scene that's on the background now is just, they're all giving this guy, you know, they've got the trophy and they're giving him a fucking trophy for, and they're all chasing after him. And it's almost like a dream. Like, you would see it in a dream sequence of what someone ideally wants. And they're, you know, he moves an inch and they move an inch with him, and they're so close to him and they're trying to give him a fucking trophy, literally. And, you know, and so you've got this whole thing through your whole life of people are telling you what you're saying is important. And even like when he was with his mum, before he went to move with this new family, his mum was saying like, oh, well, you know, it was supporting him. It's a good thing, but like he, you know, he's of importance and this, that and the other. And then he goes to this other life and then he's got like 20 fellas around him. So then you get to the point where people are telling you what you say matters so much that actually you think, well, if these 20 lads are telling me that what I'm saying matters, then everyone needs to hear what I've got to say. So mm-hmm. I'm going to control the headlines. Mm-hmm. And then when you've done, when you're bored of controlling the headlines, well, actually I want to control the news. I don't want to control what I'm saying about the news. That's, and it's like, you know, it's with Donald Trump. He, you know, he could, he's done fucking loads of things, and he's become bankrupt, you know, loads of times in his life. And he's been told that, oh, you can just continue. It doesn't matter. You know, money doesn't matter to you. You can just bankrupt yourself, and then you just continue with businesses and keep opening golf clubs and this, that, and the other. And then eventually when you get bored of that, you think, well, actually, people need to hear what I've got to say, so I'm going to run for the highest office in the world. And then when the highest office in the world runs out this year, oh, well, it must be fraud, because everyone needs to hear what I've got to say. And it's like this, the evolution, and it's fucking exactly the same in this film, and it's absolutely bananas. And last night when Liam, I'll let you jump in now, Liam, because I think you're about to say something, but last night or the night before when you said, oh my God, there's parallels, I honestly didn't really even think about it. I was just like, oh, probably because I didn't know what it was about. So I was like, oh, well, all right, then fine. You know, I was just like, oh, that's interesting. And then you come to watch it, and I was literally just like, motherfucker, he was right. Like, he was so right. And it's like, it's, you know, it really is a parallel, and it's insane how it can be such a parallel, and how he's, you know, and this guy is trying to control, he wants to be, like it says at the beginning, doesn't it, he was often the news, like he controlled the news and his life was also the news. That's where the parallels for me are, and it's like absolutely bananas. Liam, jump in, sorry man.
I think what is like even scarier about the whole kind of the tycoon and being like these, like an owner of like a conglomerate and stuff like that, is that actually, you know, he speaks about, you know, Kane speaks about in this film wanting to be president, or he could have been pretty wanted to be, but he was probably better off not being. You have more power and more influence being like the owner of like a massive kind of like news corporation. Like, I don't know, I think like going into this film with like that kind of mindset, probably I don't think you're ever going to come out of it thinking that Charles Kane is like a good guy, or you know, oh, I'm sad that he's dead. Like, he died, he had a long life. Like, it's not like he died, you know, from anything really, because it's not really specified. But yeah, that's my kind of view on like him.
I think before we just touch on the end, and then I think it is quite interesting that It's an interesting commentary that Orson Welles makes here, along with Herman J. Mankiewicz, the co-writer of the film, that everything that Charles Kane accrued from his shady and lewd dealings and the kind of awful career path he ended up going down, he lost it all. So maybe you can kind of view this as a hopeful film if you view it from that lens. But like I touched on, I when I watch films, especially films like this, I focus very heavily on what the character of Charles Kane means and what it represents in a moral or human tone. So we kind of get to the end and we find out, well, we don't really find out. The whole way through, we're trying to figure out what Rosebud means. And that's what opens the film, this kind of investigation. Did you guys see that coming?
Oh, I saw it being an inanimate object. Mm-hmm. I think I thought it was going to be something else. I can't remember what I thought it was going to be initially, but it was like, it wasn't the sled.
Yeah.
It was actually... when she was doing the puzzle, and there was a ship on the puzzle, and they couldn't find one piece, and I was wondering whether it was gonna be Rosebud, whatever.
That's interesting though, isn't it? Because they have that line that maybe Rosebud was just the missing jigsaw piece, is a line in the film.
Yeah. Maybe that's what
it's so good. Anyway, Liam, do you see it coming?
No.
The Simpsons ruin it for you. Because I remember watching the Simpsons episode of this and thinking, I have to watch Citizen Kane one day.
It's interesting though, isn't it, that I think like there is this conviction, you know, maybe like right or wrong in like old people that their childhood memories are better. And they might not be, but it just happens. I think even like now, at like the ripe old age of 23, kind of like look back maybe like 10 years ago and like, oh, were their memories better? Were they? I don't really know. But I think like once you get to old age and you start reflecting,
mm-hmm.
I think it's one of those things, isn't it, where that's kind of where he's gone to immediately, like the happy place in his childhood. you know, when he, before he was rich, you know, when he still had his innocence. And I think it makes sense. You know, it's like, it reminds him obviously of the, like his sled, which is something that made him happy. It was during a time where he was still with his mum, who he, like, the only person really arguably that he ever has loved.
Yeah,
I think, like, it does, it makes sense, really. I just didn't see it coming, to be honest. I think it would have been too obvious to be, you know, a woman, though. Like,
Yeah, I agree, yeah. Oh, sorry, I didn't know you were finished. I was just agreeing with you. So what I wrote down something because it came on the screen to me and I've scribbled it and I fucking can't even barely read it now. So, so what I did notice was, so obviously having, I watched this film fully all the way through and I've started now putting them on the background, you know, where, like, I think we've done a couple of times just to re-jog my memory a little bit because I've got a shit memory. And there was, knowing that the word, at least Rosebud, was literally the sled, maybe metaphorically it was like actually that time or that era of his life. But the first thing that you see when he's with actually in this new family is that he's given another sled. So it's like, this is your life now.
Yeah.
And the way I've viewed it now, like looking back, and this is only honestly like the last hour having seen that bit, is I didn't want this. I wanted that. And he, you know, he says it and he repeats it and he says Rosebud and like, and when he, you know, it's the last word he says before he dies, before he drops the snowy globe, he says like, you know, Rosebud, like, or to me, it's almost like I've enjoyed this.
What could have been?
But I didn't want this. I wanted that. Mm. I wanted that sled. I didn't want the new sled. I wanted the old sled. And that represents the old life. And I wanted the innocence of that. And what I've got is, you know, I imagine, you know, he's had one hell of a life, but he knows he's turned into a prick. And I didn't want that. I wanted the old stuff. And that's what Rosebud for me. And like, that's what's really cool. And I've never really, honestly, you know, with the stuff, there's films where that are famous for like, you take what you want out of it at the end. There's the story and then you've got the bit. I've never been interested at all in it. I don't really give a shit about that type of thing. And this is the only film where I've been like, fuck, this is what I believe it to be. And like, yeah. I'm actually interested in like, shit, I believe that. So that's just kind of where I'm at with it, really. I think he was just like, I could have had that and I wanted that. I didn't ever want this.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good place to end it because, well, end the plot, at least we've got a little bit more to talk about. Because genuinely though, like having, once you get to that point and you go on this journey with him and you realize almost that you bring your own interpretations of what that life would mean to you. And then you reflect it back on himself, on Charles as a character. And you do figure out that Rosebud doesn't mean anything. It's not a key code word for a spy organization or a doomsday button. It is just a hope for innocence that he lost and it was corrupted through him. I love that moment. I love that moment so much. And one thing I will touch on just before we close this bit off is that when you go back and watch this film again, that scene with the snow globe, just his last word, little tiny moments of film language mean so much to people subconsciously without people clicking onto it. And Orson Welles, it's such a weird thing to say because he does everything in this film, but Orson Welles, the director with his director hat on, does this really, really simple but really effective thing where the light's off, he goes, you kind of see him stir in his bed, the light comes on, he grabs the thing, he whispers Rosebud, he dies, light goes off again. And that little glimmer of light, to me anyway, with my film analysis hat on, is the kind of the life that could have been quickly coming back to him for 1 second, just so he can remember it, and then it's gone, and then he's gone. And I just love it so much, man. It's the little simple things like that that I just fantasize over as a wannabe filmmaker. It's so clever. Popcorns then, boys. First text for both of you. I'll go first, considering, you know, we're saving the big reveal for the end. I can't give it a first take because I watched it years ago, but with Legacy in mind, it's easily a 90 for me, easily. It holds up. It's still fun. It's got really good messages. It's still relevant and it's perfectly made. And there's one bit I forgot to talk about, but we'll just save it for another time.
I What am I going to go for? I'm going to go 79. Like a respectful 79. It's not so like that feels low because like it just does. I think when I do this, I think of FIFA ratings weirdly. So I'm like, absolutely shit that. But actually, like it's as high in 7 out of 10 as it fucking could be. Really, like
yeah.
It's basically nearly 8 out of 10, which is really good.
You never get 100 rating on FIFA, do you? So I think it's
no,
definitely...
yeah. So that's what smart. I think. But I'll go with that. And I enjoyed it. And you know, like if it came on at Christmas, which it just will do, I imagine, you know, I'd watch it again. And like, if someone was like, in a few years, I've never seen it, I'd be like, you should watch it. It's like great. And I'll properly enjoy it. But yeah, 79. I need to get out of that FIFA thing. 79.
That's funny. I like that. I do the same thing. Liam, what about yourself, mate?
I always think about it. I always go like in stars. I compare the popcorns to like stars. And
yeah, you do, don't you? Yeah, you fully do, yeah.
I on Letterboxd, I gave it 4.5, which would be 90. But I don't want to give it 90. I want to give it 85. It's better than a 4-star for me. Like, it's not quite a 5-star for me. I know a lot of people would strongly disagree. It's just, you know, if I watched it again... We say this a lot. This was a first take for me on a film that, you know, is compelling at times, is enjoyable at times, but isn't all those things throughout, in my opinion, for me.
It doesn't have that Casablanca level. You're enjoying every single moment of this.
Casablanca has that just, it, like, you know, catching lightning in a bottle. I know you said that as well for Orson Welles, but for Casablanca in particular, it was like, it was meant to be just another film. That's why it's so special. Like Citizen Kane was almost always going to be special. They knew that they were doing something special or at least interesting. Casablanca was meant to be something that wouldn't really be given a second thought. It was just one of the films, another film. But it was, yeah. Anyway, yeah, so 85 popcorns for Citizen Kane.
Awesome.
Would watch again, 100%.
Sick. Well,
I'm just going to go with one thing really quickly. So I'm only going to say this because I've just come off the film onto iPlayer. This film is on iPlayer, so if you haven't, well, I don't know why you're listening if you haven't seen it, but if you haven't seen it in ages, you should watch it on iPlayer. But also they've honestly got like 20 like under a section called Silver Screen Classics. They've just got a load of like classic films, old films from like the kind of the 40s and stuff. And I might try my hardest to watch them, which probably means I won't because I can't find it hard to watch new things anyway. But I just think if anyone's interested, then that is there for you on iPlayer.
That's good as well, because if you did make it this far through the podcast and you actually haven't watched Citizen Kane, I would implore you to do that, because next week we're talking about the new David Fincher film, Mank, which, as we've touched on a little bit here, focuses on Herman J. Mankiewicz, who was the really strange and weird and elusive co-producer and co-writer of Citizen Kane with Orson Welles. He lived a very interesting life, and it's Gary Oldman, who is one of the best actors going at the minute, who plays Mankiewicz in this film. It comes out on Friday, I think. By the time you're listening to this podcast, it'll be out. Please give it a watch. Fire all your questions into us. You can get us at First Take Pod on Twitter and Instagram.
Do we know if Orson Welles has been depicted in this film?
I think he is, but not by the guy I hoped he would be played by. He'd be played by the guy that played Han Solo, which is a weird...
I can see that, definitely.
Well, if any Hollywood casting agents are getting there, hit me up at Connor Norcott or at First Take Pod on Twitter and Instagram. you can sort me out. Anyway, until next week, fellas, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, and I'll see you later.